This is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as a person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now we turn to the inside of the Triangle Business Journal for the week, and we find the biz page with an article under the heading of New Exhibit, and it's entitled Scott Avitt Unveils a Painter's Touch at NCMA. The North Carolina Museum of Art has had some blockbuster exhibits in the past, but a recent one created a bunch of buzz as Scott Avitt of the Avitt Brothers displayed his work. Avitt isn't just playing with a paintbrush when he's not leading the band. He majored in fine arts at East Carolina University, and as a display with a touch of Van Gogh shows, Avitt has some skills as an artist. His subjects were often his children and wife, Sarah. Avitt and his family, including his brother Seth and his parents, attended a special gathering October the 10th that drew 200 people. Another event on October the 11th drew 600 people to the museum's East Building. The exhibit opens to the public October 26th in conjunction with a Frida Kahlo exhibit. And under the heading of Great Run comes the article, Restaurant Owner Who Brought Pita Bread to Raleigh Is Now Retiring. After more than four decades serving Mediterranean fare to customers in the Triangle, Neil Mon's co-founder is stepping down. Samir Sam Saleh, 67, started Neil Mon's Mediterranean with his family in 1977 after arriving from Lebanon. We introduced the pita bread in 1977 in the Raleigh area. It was something new, something out of nowhere, he says. The company expanded its offerings and ultimately opened restaurants in Raleigh, Durham, and Marshall. Saleh's family grew as well. Saleh has two children and four grandchildren. Recently, the family began searching for a successor. They reached out to Blanny Ching Miller, who had worked as general counsel and advisor. The family offered her the job, and she accepted, taking on the role of president in September. And under the heading of Inside the Beltline comes the article, White Oak Road Home Sells and Could Get Demolished. An estate in a prime Raleigh location that's been the subject of long court battle has been sold for $2.1 million to a couple from Cary. Anuj and Benita Mittal, who own the MJM Group, closed on the property October the 9th. We believe it's one of the best locations in the Triangle area, Anuj Mittal says. He said he and his wife plan to make it their primary residence, and we'll see how much of the house they can fix up in the short term. But he says, our long-term plan is to demolish it and rebuild. He said they may put two or three homes on the property. A federal bankruptcy judge on June 21st approved the sale for $2.1 million. The property at 2529 White Oak Road includes 2.97 acres and a 3,446-square-foot home built in 1938. The property has a tax value of $2.16 million. The home had been owned for years by Celeste Gold Broughton. She previously had been married to Robert Broughton, the son of former North Carolina Governor J. Melville Broughton. And under the heading of Expanding comes the article, Improved Nature Moves into New York Market. Garner-based protein manufacturer Improved Nature just made its retail debut. The company's plant-based chicken alternatives are now on ShopRite supermarket shelves in the New York metro area. The line offers four products, Nature's Nuggets, Nature's Tenders, Nature's Fillets, and Nature's Large Fillets. The company, founded in 2015 by Rody Hawkins, operates out of the tiny town of Garner, but is eyeing a world stage, as global data predicts the global market for plant-based foods will reach $5.2 billion by 2020. And under the heading of For Sale comes the article, Plantation in Warren County Goes on the Market. An hour from Raleigh, a home is for sale that's rooted in another century. Elgin Plantation, located in the farm country east of Warrenton, dates to 1827 and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The Federal-style home is on the market for $3.9 million and includes the charm you'd expect in a home from that era, with high ceilings, aged wood floors, and heavy crown molding. The grounds include a cabin that dates to around 1790, but also has plenty of modern amenities, including a three-car garage and even two elevators. Listing agent Alex Weeble says the owners have grandkids coming along and are looking to relocate. The plantation once stretched to 2,000 acres, but is now around 300. Before the Civil War, when cotton and tobacco made fortunes for landowners in eastern North Carolina, Warren County was the home to extensive plantations. The 1860 census listed only 4,900 whites in the county, but 10,400 slaves. And finally, on the biz page, under the heading of On the Market, comes the article, Big Part of Topsoil for Sale, but Some Raise Concerns. A massive swath of Topsoil Island is for sale, although how much of the land can be developed is being disputed. A total of 110 acres on the south end of the island is on the market for $7.95 million. Agent Paul Lucas of Cape Fear Commercial has the listing, which calls it a very unique opportunity to purchase one of the last remaining large oceanfront tracts in the region. The listing also notes that the island is migrating south, suggesting that future changes in the island's landscape would not be detrimental to the value of the land. But one group is questioning the value of the land, the North Carolina Coastal Federation. Todd Miller, executive director of the Federation, issued a thunderous news release in which he said, "There are significant long-standing regulatory and economic impediments that make it nearly impossible to develop." Among the concerns the Federation raised, it said the land is in a Coastal Barrier Resources Act zone, which it says would make it ineligible for federal flood insurance or disaster relief. According to Pender County records, the land is owned by the McLeod Family LLC of Wake Forest. Franklin McLeod of Wake Forest is the LLC's manager, according to the North Carolina Secretary of State's office. McLeod, asked about the Federation's claim, says, "I'm not sure if they are correct or not. We'll have to wait and see how it all works out." He bought the property in 1998 and says potential buyers have asked about it, but he noted that the sale would be complicated. Next, we turn to the transportation and tech page of this week's journal. And under the heading of Sudden Change comes the article, Red Hat Dismisses CFO Without Pay and Puts Krebs in Job. Without warning, Red Hat confirmed the ouster of Eric Shander, the chief financial officer who helped the open-source software giant through the IBM deal. In his stead comes Lori Krebs, senior vice president of finance. Krebs has nearly three decades of experience from the likes of Nortel and Cree. Red Hat has confirmed Shander's departure was a dismissal without pay, but declined to provide further details. The news came 3 months after IBM's $34 billion buyout of Red Hat closed. Shander was in line for a $4 million bonus if he stayed on for 1 year following the IBM merger. And under the heading of Flight Fights comes the article, Delta Shrugs at Competition from Cheap Cost Carriers. The top executives at Raleigh-Durham International Airport's largest airline by passenger count aren't worried about its fastest-growing RDU competitor, at least not according to Delta Airlines CEO Ed Bastian. On a recent earnings call, Bastian reiterated that ultra-low-cost carriers aren't the competition. That's as ULCCs are growing at RDU, particularly Frontier Airlines. "Basic economy is not something we want to grow," Bastian told analysts. "It's not really a premium product, and as we've outlined before, a defensive product against ULCCs. We want to have best-in-class product, whatever people's needs are. And for people who only care about the lowest fare possible, I think we have by far the best offering." Now, also in this article is a list of the top five airlines in terms of in-plane passenger market share through August the 30th. Delta has 30.1%. American, 22.5%. Southwest, 18.3%. United, 11.8%, and Frontier, 7.4%. And under the heading of futuristic travel comes the article, Jetsons Would Love This Ride. Imagine shooting through a tube at 671 miles per hour, traveling from Raleigh to Washington, D.C. via a half-hour commute. It's not science fiction, it's reality. For us, it's not whether Hyperloop is going to happen, it's when, says Ryan Kelly, head of marketing for Virgin Hyperloop One, which confirms the Triangle is among the places it's considering for a test track of the technology. Kelly and Kristen Hammer, leader of Virgin Hyperloop's materials engineering team, were in town October the 10th and 11th to meet with stakeholders and showcase the technology. The momentum has picked up, and North Carolina and the RTA, that's the Regional Transportation Alliance, they're looking at whether or not this would be a good place to have a certification track, Kelly explains. Dubbed a certification center, the test track, planned for completion by 2024, would allow Virgin Hyperloop to obtain safety certification. If all goes well, real routes would follow with passengers as early as 2029. The step between here and production routes is a certification center, where we basically build everything out to show to regulators that we are ready and safe, Hammer says. The Triangle has several advantages when it comes to hosting that certification center. Its universities and tech-centric companies would offer a big boost to a Hyperloop system. Kelly says the presence of top-tier companies in the region makes for a great opportunity for our supply chain. He says Hyperloop will require embedded hardware systems, software platforms, and engineering expertise, a great fit for the Triangle. We've had some really positive, nice conversations with the Research Triangle area, Kelly says. They won't say where specifically they're considering in the Triangle for a certification track. They're hoping to finalize a community by the spring. Other locations on Virgin Hyperloop's roadshow include Columbus, Ohio, Arlington, Texas, Kansas City, New York, Columbia, Missouri, St. Louis, and Washington, D.C. In the Triangle, the pod was on display in Pittsburgh at the Triangle J Council of Governments Regional Summit. Next, we turn the page and arrive at the healthcare and education page of this week's journal. And under the heading of On the Move comes the article, FastMed, to put head office in downtown Raleigh. One of the country's largest urgent care providers is moving its North Carolina corporate offices into the heart of downtown Raleigh, a testament to both its expanding presence and the growing residential population of the area. FastMed Urgent Care has announced plans to move its North Carolina corporate staff from Clayton into the former Father and Son Antiques location on West Hargett Street between Fayetteville Street and the Warehouse District. FastMed officials say the location will be the new home to approximately 100 corporate staff, though the number is expected to continue to grow. The company operates 109 clinics across Arizona, North Carolina, and Texas. Its first clinic was opened in Clayton in 2005. It operates 58 clinics in North Carolina. And under the heading of Orange County comes the article, Move Over, UNC. Duke Health plans to expand into Orange County. With state approval behind it, Duke Health is moving ahead with plans to open a new ambulatory surgery center in Orange County, marking its first operating room expansion into Carolina Blue Territory. According to records obtained from the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, that's NCDHHS, which regulates expansion of healthcare services through the state's Certificate of Need process, Duke Health has received approval of its application to locate an ambulatory surgery center in Chapel Hill. The health system plans to locate a $12 million ambulatory surgical center at the location, complete with two operating rooms and two procedure rooms. Currently, there are 41 operating rooms located in Orange County, all of which are based at UNC hospitals. The decision comes after both Duke and UNC proposed projects, with UNC requesting approval to expand its main campus hospital for an additional three rooms. The $6.7 million expansion would lead to the hospital having a total of 44 operating rooms upon completion. However, based on the state's approval of Duke's project, UNC was granted only one operating room. And in addition to Duke taking up the availability of operating rooms UNC could have utilized, the approval also means increased competition in a county traditionally dominated by UNC's health system. In its Certificate of Need application, Duke projects that by the end of the center's third fiscal year, that's in 2024, its new center will serve 3,552 patients annually, with nearly 50% coming from Alamance County. It projects 1,327 patients will come from Orange County and another 466 from Chatham. Health systems have been moving toward ambulatory surgical centers in recent years because many outpatient procedures can be performed outside of a hospital, and that leads to considerably reduced prices for those services. In 2017, according to NCDHHS, Orange County residents flocked to other counties for their outpatient procedures, with 50% of them going to Durham County. Only 39% of outpatient services performed on Orange County residents were performed in county. The approximately 3,700 surgeries performed outside of Orange County represents a huge potential for the providers that can expand outpatient offerings in the county. In fact, Duke's newest center is projected to bring in $12.2 million in net revenue by its third fiscal year in operation, averaging $3,431 net revenue per case. And continuing with the healthcare and education page from this week's journal, under the heading of Trustee Dispute, comes the article, UNC Drops Suit Against Greenville Hospital. The University of North Carolina System and Vidant Health in Greenville have reached a settlement in a lawsuit launched over abrupt changes to how members of the hospital's governing board are chosen. The UNC system filed a lawsuit in May following a decision by the Pitt County Board of Commissioners to change Vidant Medical Center's Articles of Incorporation to remove UNC's role in selecting Board of Trustee members. Under the terms of the settlement, Pitt County will retain its 11 seats. 7 will be nominated from Vidant Health and approved by the UNC System Board of Governors, and the Dean of the Brody School of Medicine and the Chancellor of East Carolina will fill the remaining 2 seats. Before the change earlier this year, UNC had been involved in the process for decades. Under the original framework, the hospital's 20-member board was selected by Pitt County, which appointed 11, and the UNC Board of Governors, which named the remaining 9. The amended framework that prompted the lawsuit configured the board so as 9 members were chosen from a slate recommended by Vidant Health, with Pitt County retaining its 11 appointments, effectively cutting the UNC system out of the process. And finally, on the healthcare and education page this week, Inside the Numbers reveals the article, Florida and Virginia Lead New Residents to North Carolina. North Carolina's population is booming, and it owes much of that growth to residents coming from out of state. According to new research released by the Carolina Demography, located within UNC Chapel Hill's Carolina Population Center, the state has grown by 848,000 people since the 2010 census. That's an approximate 9% increase. As of 2018, the state's population stretched to 10.4 million. Rebecca Tippett, the director of Carolina Demography, says that since 2015, the state averages 110,000 new residents each year. 75% come from out of state. For example, in 2017, North Carolina grew by 113,000 new residents. Just 26,000 came from a higher birth than death rate. The remaining 87,000 came from more people moving to North Carolina than those leaving the state. The center's data suggests that during 2017, about 281,000 moved out of North Carolina, with more than 368,000 moving in. The most popular previous residences for people moving to North Carolina in 2017 were Florida with 32,000, Virginia with 29,000, South Carolina with 27,000, tied with New York at 27,000, and California with 20,000. Tippett says that the increase in population continues a steady trend the state has seen, outside a period of decline during the recession. She says that, like states such as Texas, North Carolina benefits from a stickiness that keeps many residents in state, while also attracting others for economic and professional opportunities. This is less than a population boom, and more a continuation of trends we've seen for well over a decade now, she says. As we move further from the Great Recession, we've seen population trends rebound to familiar patterns. Next, we turn to the real estate page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of What's Next comes the article, New Mixed-Use Project Plan. Site work will soon begin on a 400-acre mixed-use development in Holly Springs, with plans calling for over 1 million square feet of commercial space and 1,700 residential units. Shenandoah Homes, in partnership with national home builder Lennar, has announced its plans for Carolina Springs, a massive master-planned community that will develop 396 acres. The project is situated at 7300 Wood Creek Road, near the intersection of US 1 and Interstate 540. Carolina Springs will be built in five phases, with the final phase expected to be finished in 2027. According to site plans filed with the town of Holly Springs, Carolina Springs will be split into four districts: Town Center District, Innovation District, Village Square District, and the Neighborhood District. Now, each of these described Town Center, about 21 acres with 120 to 400,000 square feet of non-residential space. Maximum residential density, 8 units per acre. Development can be up to 4 stories. Primary use is listed as commercial. The Innovation District, approximately 36 acres with 200,000 to 500,000 square feet of non-residential space. Maximum residential density is 8 units per acre. Development can be up to 12 stories. Primary uses are listed as office, hotel, and indoor sport. The Village Square District, approximately 76 acres with 20,000 to 100,000 square feet of non-residential space. Maximum residential density, 15 units per acre. Development can be up to 5 stories. Primary use is residential mixed use. And finally, the Neighborhood District, about 135 acres with up to 20,000 square feet of non-residential space. Maximum residential density is 4.5 units per acre. Development can be up to 3 stories. Primary use is residential. All of the districts will be connected through a series of public spaces and walking trails, and plans also include a 25-acre park and a fire station. Shenandoah Homes owner David Stallings says work on the first phases is expected to begin next year. This will be by far the largest and most overwhelming undertaking we've taken up, he says. Stallings put the property under contract 2 years ago and began working with the town to flesh out the kind of development he could build on the site. The property was previously owned by Duke Energy. We ended up originally asking for 610 units, but the future land use plan had the land being a business park, he says. The town asked us to include another piece of property, and they wanted us to make it a truly urban setting. He rearranged his plans, ultimately adding nearly 1,100 units and 1 million square feet of retail to the initial proposals. And under the heading of Warehouse District comes the article, New Plans Filed for Apartments and Hotel in Downtown Raleigh. Plans appear to have changed for a major mixed-use development proposed for the edge of the Warehouse District in Raleigh. Longtime Raleigh developer Clancy and Thays Construction Company submitted site plans earlier this month for a 3-building development that would rise 6 stories at the site of the company's long-time headquarters on West Cabarrus Street. Kane Realty Corp. is the developer of the project. The filings did not list total square feet or provide a breakdown of the space, and did not specify any number of apartments or hotel rooms. The development's footprint will be about 6 acres, or about 264,800 square feet, and would feature a parking deck and associated utilities. The property is situated on 6.8 acres at 600 615, and 400 West Cabarrus Street, just across the train tracks from the warehouse district. Clancy & Thays has had its headquarters there since the 1970s. The land has been under contract with Kane Realty Corporation since last year, and the companies had previously proposed a much different vision for the property. In October of 2018, Kane filed a rezoning request with the city to allow for the development of a 20-story tower on one portion of the property, with two accompanying structures up to 5 or 6 stories tall. The request, however, appeared to run into some resistance, including the unanimous opposition of the city's Citizens Advisory Council. The companies pulled the request late last month. For now, the zoning will limit development on the property to 7 stories of mixed use. Now we turn to the On Business page of this week's journal, and under the heading of Positive Trend comes the article, Women-Owned Businesses Are on the Rise. Women-owned businesses are on the rise across the country, a trend that includes North Carolina and Raleigh. An annual report of census data found women-owned businesses are growing at a rate more than 2 times faster than all businesses nationwide. In the Raleigh area, the number of businesses owned by women increased from an estimated 41,000 in 2014 to 50,000 in 2018. That growth rate of more than 22% ranked 16th among the nation's top 50 metro areas. In 2018, estimated sales for women-owned firms in the area totaled more than $7 billion. The report, commissioned by American Express and based on data from the Census Bureau's Survey of Business Owners, found many women are starting businesses as a part-time operation. The face of entrepreneurship is evolving to include all women, regardless of demographics. Even more impressive is that women are starting businesses on their own terms, whether it be their full-time focus or a part-time activity, says Courtney Kelso, Senior Vice President of American Express. Nationally, the report found that women-owned businesses continue to fuel the economy and now represent 42% of all businesses. And a little sidebar in this article says that North Carolina's national rank in the increase of women-owned firms since 2014 is now 9th, with a 14.9% increase. Now we come to this week's cover story, which is entitled, Is It Time to Deal? Shaw University and St. Augustine's University are longtime rivals, but it may be time for them to work together. For Shaw University President Paulette Dillard, the history of the university she leads is impossible to forget, especially in her office in Estee Hall. Located on the fourth floor, everything about the former dormitory seems to demand the senses recognizes history, from its floor plan of equally spaced bedrooms turned offices, to countless portraits of leaders long at rest, and the creak of its hardwood floors. The landmark is also a monument to the university's place in time. Built in 1873, it stands as the first building constructed for the education of black women in the United States, on the campus of the oldest historically black university in the South. And like the building in the heart of downtown Raleigh, Shaw University has endured and survived the ebbs and flows of change since its founding. But now, as enrollments dwindle and dollars remain tight, Shaw finds itself leaning on long-term rival St. Augustine's University to share faculty, and even calls its rival's football field home. Beginning this fall, the executive leadership of Shaw and St. Augustine's have begun meeting their counterparts to explore how they can share resources to reduce costs and ensure they go on to be more than just historic. But don't call it a merger. God forbid that gets implied, Dillard says, because with our alumni, we'd both be run out of town. Yet hard times make for strange bedfellows, and both the Baptist Shaw and the Episcopalian St. Augustine's have seen their share of challenges in the evolving higher education landscape. In the most recently disclosed financial data for both universities, Shaw saw an annual deficit of $2.7 million, and St. Aug's saw $1.1 million in deficit spending. Yet while the universities are pinching pennies, just outside Dillard's window looms the Red Hat logo, a testament to the record value and development land in close proximity to downtown is enjoying. Both universities have land in spades, putting them right in the crosshairs of the city's future growth. And though operating budgets reach to just $48 million at Shaw and $30 million at St. Augustine's, they sit on property worth more than $93 million and $60 million respectively, even by conservative tax valuations. I think the city is going to move that way, our downtown core, says North Carolina Football Club owner Steve Malik, who's pushing for a sports and entertainment complex not far from the Shaw campus. Frankly, when you look at the north or south boundaries, that's the only way it can move. And just how closely the futures of two universities could align will be clear on October the 19th, when Shaw will host its homecoming football game at its longtime rivals' stadium. In the world of HBCUs, it's as if UNC Chapel Hill held a home basketball game at Cameron Indoor Stadium. Located just a couple miles northeast in Oakwood on a sprawling 105-acre campus, the Episcopal Diocese of North Carolina opened in St. Mary Augustine's in 1867 as a place to educate former slaves. Over time, enrollment reached as high as 1,800 students per semester. But this fall, the school has only 864 full-time students. To put that in perspective, that enrollment is only one-third the size of Enloe High School, which is an easy walk from the St. Augustine's campus. That enrollment figure represents a 38% decrease in enrollment in the last 10 years. In fact, the university's financial situation became so worrisome during that period that it was placed on probation from the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges between 2016 and 2018. Now off probation, the enrollment has slightly improved for the first time, growing to current 864 from a low of 767 students last year. But application numbers are still diving. According to data provided by the university, first-time freshman applications for fall 2018 numbered 4,347. This fall, that figure had dropped to 2,808. University President Gaddis Falcon remains hopeful, though open about the challenges the university faces. Falcon, an energetic administrator fond of quoting a vast array of personalities, spent decades working at both Shaw, including as its interim president, and St. Augustine's, when he took leadership of the university in March. He spent his months since working on shoring up its financial model and working on enrollment. The business model, as it exists for us, it will not work, he says. The business model of being tuition-driven and using only enrollment, using students as the main income source. That much seems apparent by the recent financial metrics. Since 2015, the university has consistently operated in a deficit, as much as $3.4 million in 2016. According to current financial data disclosed by the university, it projects a budget surplus of only $106,554 in 2019. Those razor-sharp margins are a start, but far from the recovery it hopes to see. Instead, Falcon says the university needs to focus on creating new lines of revenue and student services outside of the traditional four-year model. Just this year, he says, the school received approval for its first online degree program. But while he's waiting for an enrollment and program-centric strategy to begin paying off, Falcon says St. Augustine's can't afford to just wait on the revenue. Napoleon Hill says nothing worthwhile occurs without someone taking initiative, he says, quoting the American author. That's what we're doing. Less than 3 miles on the other side of Raleigh, Shaw enjoys only slightly steadier ground than its counterpart. According to his chief financial officer, David Byrd, the university has managed to operate with a surplus for the last fiscal year after 3 years of continuous deficits. Byrd notes it has not operated in the red since he arrived just over a year ago and is not projected to again this year. However, when asked to provide the most recent financial data, the university declined, saying that as a private college, they do not disclose financial information prior to reporting requirements. Shaw has seen its share of enrollment trouble. Full-time enrollment was as high as 3,076 in 2007 and has since fallen to just 1,550 in the last academic year. One promising sign could be application numbers, which, after declining for years, jumped from 5,030 in 2015 to 12,060 in 2017. However, during the same period, graduation rates have dropped from 30% to 18%. Shaw officials also declined to provide enrollment data for the most recent year. But weighing against whatever revenue the university can bring is a direct consequence of what it's most proud of, its long history. Spotted across its campus are buildings such as Estee Hall, landmarks demanding constant upkeep. In fact, Bird says the university's biggest cost is maintenance and renovations. Our buildings are aging, and every time we build something, that's money not used for deferred maintenance, he says. A building can last 100 years, but the things inside it cannot. So my biggest challenge is making sure my plant operates well enough for my customers, the student body. According to the university's most recent federal report, 40% of its expenses went to institutional support. Shaw declined to specify what its total deferred maintenance need is. Meeting those needs is the heart of the two schools' exploration of combining operations. Exact details of the arrangement are still speculative, with the universities first enabling their respective presidents, chief financial officers, and provost to meet this fall. Fulkin says he imagines consolidating existing assets, especially faculty and facilities that are not being fully utilized because of lower enrollments. For example, if we have a great chemistry professor and they don't have one, they don't have to hire one, he says. That could pay for half of that great professor. Synog's chief financial officer, Alan Robertson, says sharing faculty alone could have transformative effects on the university. If we're able to pool some of our academic programs, that could be quite considerable, he says, because we were at 1,800 students, and a large part of that part of the academy hasn't been adjusted to or sized to our current population. For Shaw, the flagship of the evolving partnership between the two institutions is the shared use of St. Aug's football stadium, which, beginning this year, Shaw uses as its home field. We're going to try that this year, and it's really just a way to demonstrate to the public that we do talk to each other, Shaw's Dillard says. We do look for cost-sharing arrangements. Dillard also says the school is exploring partnerships and deals with as many companies and institutions in the regions as they can. We're doing much more of that than we have in the past because we recognize that that has to be the model, she says. For Shaw leadership, sharing costs is not the only integral part of its vision for the future. Dillard says the university's greatest asset is its land. More than 20 acres of dormitories, classrooms, and administrative buildings located close to fast-growing corporations. Dillard says the university is trying to lean into the budding industries in the Triangle, such as biotechnology. She says not only is the university trying to shift its own internal resources and grant proposals toward those industries, but the school is looking to make connections with companies to act as direct training programs for future employees. We're just recognizing where we can target our resources and our interest in that space, she says. That's where Shaw is now. We're sort of quietly saying, where can we fit? We've been enthusiastic about the conversations that we've had with companies and organizations who want to get their arms around this talent pipeline. Her hope, she says, is that Shaw will integrate itself into the future prosperity and growth of Raleigh and the region. I have this vision that I will be Raleigh's urban university, she says, and what that means is that the city will be coming and going on my campus as if it's just another block in the city. That future may not be far off, says Malik. He says as downtown spreads south, the area around Shaw will become an area of rapid development, perhaps even Shaw's holdings. The thing with their property is that they've got a considerable amount altogether, he says. You just don't see that much together, and I think that allows for some denser or bigger plans if they choose to either develop it themselves, or there's so much of it, there are parts right there around the Performing Arts Center that a lot more can be done. According to county records, Shaw's main campus of about 25 acres has a total land and building valuation of over $93 million. Malik says the value may be considerably higher. Though a bit further from the central hub of downtown, St. Augs also believe that its land may be its most valuable asset, though much more literally. According to Robertson, who has since left the university, its campus sits on about 105 acres, of which it uses about 50%. We'll continue to look at other avenues to diversify our revenue, including some ideas about real estate, he says. We have very valuable real estate. With a very conservative valuation of about $120 million, Robertson says the university is involved in discussions for long-term leases of some of its land, though the university declined to be specific. Falcon says while it does not plan to sell its main land, the university owns about 40 parcels separate from its main plot that it may consider selling off. The financial opportunity for the university could be tremendous. According to records of sales in the neighborhood surrounding the university, a 0.13-acre lot sold for as much as $405,000 earlier this year, and the university itself paid $7.2 million for a 0.13-acre lot just across the street in late 2017. While the future for both universities remains unclear, the transformative effect the present circumstances are having are already abundantly clear. All this season, crowds of garnet-clad Shaw University students descended upon St. Augustine's football stadium as Shaw plays its home games on its rival's field. While a familiar sight during season games in which the rival Falcons and Bears square off and a time-honored rivalry, this time was different. Sporting home colors as bleachers filled with Shaw and some curious St. Augustine students and alumni, cheerleaders and flag bearers flew Shaw University's banners with pride in the literal shadow of a St. Augs scoreboard. On October the 19th, hundreds of Shaw fans will crowd into those same stands, the stands of their rival school, for its homecoming game. But to university officials, the cooperation does not mean the schools are less competitive. It's just proof that they continue to share the same common goal developed over more than a century. We're competitive on the field, and we're competitive on the court, Dilder says. But when it comes to what we need to do as institutions, we do a lot more talking about how we can leverage partnerships than I think the public believes. And as usual, following the cover story each week comes the executive voice column. This week's executive voice belongs to Mitch Taylor. And the article is entitled, Reluctant Son Finds a Passion in Business of Pest Control. When he was young, Mitch Taylor didn't plan on someday taking over the family business. In fact, he says, he had his eyes set on being a sports agent like the Tom Cruise character Jerry Maguire. But after graduating from NC State University with the goal of becoming a sports agent, Taylor started working full-time at the company his father started the year Taylor was born, nearly 38 years ago. Fast forward to the present. Taylor is serving as president of the family business, Capital Pest Services. And he's helped the Raleigh company nearly triple in size during the last decade. Taylor's been with the pest control company full-time for about 15 years, ever since he graduated from NC State, where he studied sports law and management. But he grew up around the company his father, Steve, had started after borrowing $5,000 from a friend following years with another pest control business. It wasn't anything I thought I would do, Taylor says, about how he viewed the company when he was young. I loved going to the office, growing up, going to meetings, and traveling around. The more time Taylor spent on the job after college, he says, the more he saw the potential to make it a career. It wasn't really until I got finished with school and was tossing around the idea of whether or not I was going to law school, Taylor says, about when he decided to go in the family business. It was at that time that he really started to see the opportunities, not just financially, but to be able to help homeowners. Many homeowners are uninformed about the risk of termite damage, Taylor says. And people are devastated when they find out their home is eaten up by termites, and nobody's going to help them pay for it. Taylor, who had worked part-time at the company during college, started out like any other new employee, on the termite truck digging trenches. As he learned more about the business, he saw there was room for growth. The industry was starting to change. I could see things in our company that I was trying to push for, maybe a little earlier than my father wanted me to push for change in those areas, mainly on the technological side, marketing and advertising and branding, Taylor says. The company took a big hit during the recession when home building slowed dramatically. Prepping new homes for termite protection had always been the company's dominant revenue stream. Taylor says, adding his father had done a great job building lasting relationships with the region home builders during the company's first three decades in business. But the recession put many of the company's home builder customers out of business, or they were swallowed up by large national units. From 2007 to 2009, Capital Pest Services had around 10 employees and saw its annual revenues drop from around $1.6 million to $1.2 million. It was an eye-opener, Taylor says, but also a time to implement necessary change. For the company's first 30 years, Taylor says, it didn't have an advertising budget. So after some convincing, his father let him set up a budget for advertising and marketing, around $24,000 for the first year. About half of that money went toward developing a website, while the rest went toward straightforward marketing items such as branded logo pins and chip clips. The next task for Taylor was improving the efficiency of the company's workflow. Get away from old, outdated scheduling software and move to a cloud-based mobile system that gives customers more options, he says. Today, the company's advertising budget has grown to around $180,000 per year, Taylor says. Capital Pest Services has a complete digital marketing plan, including a website that allows potential customers to chat directly with staff based at the office on Becky Circle in North Raleigh. Taylor was promoted to general manager in 2012 and began overseeing the company's sales, marketing, and day-to-day operations. He implemented a sales training program to focus more on cross-selling to current customers. That was one of the biggest turning points in our company, the first handful of years where our sales program was in place, Taylor says. In 2015, Taylor was named company president after his dad decided to retire, coming at the same time the company went through a major software upgrade. Today, Capital Pest Services has grown to more than 30 employees. Taylor's brother, Zachary, serves as vice president and operations manager, and Taylor expects revenue this year to be well above $3 million. The company continues to grow its termite business, he says, but it has also built up its other services, such as mosquito spraying and ant control, to where there is now a much more even balance in terms of revenue streams. That growth has been supported by the Triangle's booming housing industry, Taylor says. The company operates in a 75-mile radius around Raleigh, and Taylor says there's enough market share to go around for his company and its competitors. Like his father, Taylor is a past president of the North Carolina Pest Management Association. I want customers to use a professional service, whether it's with our company or whether it's one of my competitors, he says. And although advances in technology have made the pest management job safer and more efficient, Taylor says some things will always be the same. The one thing that hasn't changed is a good old-fashioned termite inspection. You need a good flashlight, you need a good probing device, and you need to be disciplined in what you're looking for, he says. And a little short article from the real estate page entitled Crane Watch, New Apartments Proposed Near Triangle Town Center. A developer has plans for hundreds of apartments on real estate near a Raleigh shopping center. Carolina Project Equities, LLC, submitted site plans earlier this month for The Point at Town Center, a proposed 636,000-square-foot apartment community across the street from Pointer Place and the Triangle Town Center. The project would include 484 units with a mix of senior living and affordable family apartment options. The undeveloped site is situated on 25 acres at 3900 Sumner Boulevard, just south of the Triangle Town Center. Wake County values the property at $4.85 million. Plans include 180 senior living units, 12 one-bedroom units, 104 two-bedroom units, and 188 three-bedroom units. Now we turn to the viewpoint page of this week's journal, and we find the guest article entitled, Politicians Should Consider Urban Realities, and it's written by John Hood. In 2012, 92% of North Carolina workers commuted to their places of employment by automobile. By 2018, that share had dipped to 90%. But before mass transit advocates get excited, I should hasten to add that the share of North Carolinians commuting by public transportation remained the same at a minuscule 1%. Moreover, the decline in auto commuting from 2012 to 2018 occurred entirely among those who carpool. The share of commuters driving alone stayed the same at 81%, as did the share of those walking, 2%, and using other modes such as paid ride-sharing, 1%. So, if carpooling went down, what went up? The share of North Carolinians who work mostly from home rose 2 points to 6%. The least expensive, least frustrating, and least polluting way to commute is not to do it at all. The growth of home-based work is especially pronounced in urban areas. Some 9% of workers in Mecklenburg County, 10% in Wake and Orange counties, and 11% in Buncombe County worked from home last year, according to the latest survey data from the U.S. Census Bureau. As you might expect, other alternatives to automobile commuting are also more common in urban areas. Still, the proportions remain quite low. The county with the highest share of commuting by transit is university-dominated Orange, but it's only 6%. Mecklenburg County may have shiny trains and streetcars, but at 3%, its transit share is not a great deal higher than the 1% or so in Wake, Guilford, Forsyth, Buncombe, and New Hanover. Politicians have been talking a lot about the implications of rapid growth in our urban and suburban areas, as well as the challenges posed by stagnation or decline in many rural areas. Such talk is valuable as long as policymakers keep certain realities in mind. No matter how much politicians may wish it were otherwise, North Carolinians are unlikely to flock in significant numbers to mass transit as a means of getting to work or making other regular trips. I think it's entirely appropriate for cities to fund bus systems as a low-cost mobility option. That doesn't mean transit will be truly mass in North Carolina in the foreseeable future. Relaxing zoning codes, minimum lot sizes, and other regulations would have another welcome benefit in North Carolina's urbanizing areas: downward pressure on housing prices and rents. We have artificial restrictions on supply, even if more affluent North Carolinians are the ones most likely to buy downtown condos or rent in trendy high-rises, their decisions would free up other housing stock for other customers. There's an emerging consensus that we currently practice exclusionary zoning. But here's another reality urban policymakers need to accept. You can't fix the problem with inclusionary zoning, with ordering developers to set aside some units as affordable housing in exchange for permits. The answer is to dismantle the barriers themselves. Let's get started. And this week's editor's notebook is entitled, Business Sector Won Big in Raleigh Elections. In the end, it really wasn't that surprising. There had been a whisper campaign of frustration among the business community, primarily developers, but also city employees and area residents, who felt that the elected city officials at one of the country's fastest-growing metros were not doing their jobs. The so-called NIMBY crowd inside the Raleigh City Council just wasn't ready to address growth, density, and seismic demographic shift happening in our city. So the voters on October the 8th threw almost all of them out. Mary Ann Baldwin, Raleigh's new mayor, will have a supportive council with her. Go on our council members Steph Mendel, Kay Crowder, Dickie Thompson, and Russ Stevenson. David Cox survived, but his vote will not matter in most cases. That leaves newcomers Sage Martin, Jonathan Melton, David Knight, Patrick Bufkin, and incumbents Corey Branch and Nicole Stewart to shape Raleigh's tomorrow. Without a doubt, Raleigh's business community is ecstatic with the election outcome. To most of them, especially the ones trying to build and grow the city's tax base and density, their plans were not given a fair shot. The word among the development community was that City Manager Ruffin Hall balked at bringing new plans in front of the council in fear of getting ridiculed or shot down. Four developers, John Kane, Andy Andrews, Ted Klink, that's the new Highwoods property CEO, and many others, this may be the best time to accelerate plans for downtown Raleigh. If they have a bold vision for the city, now's the time for them to come forward. Some projects are already in the hopper and are likely to be green-lighted soon after the new city council is sworn in come December. This also is the time to address affordability. Baldwin or his council must address this now, like in the first few weeks. They must bring developers, members of various housing authorities, and finance professionals in one room and start discussing options. If they don't make this one of their biggest priorities, the mayor and most of the elected newly elected members could be gone after their first term. Some recent myopic rules enacted by the city council, such as Airbnb and accessory dwelling unit requirements, will most likely be reversed. And scooter companies such as Bird and Lime will be given a new lease on life so they can once again offer alternative transportation to our urban core. Downtown South development champion Steve Malik also should be happy because Baldwin came out and supported public funds for the massive $1.9 billion project. The source of the funds may be different, however. Look out for discussions starting on funding Downtown South through tax increment financing. It's a very risky play, but the project deserves discussion in the public domain. Finally, in terms of economic development, a note of caution to Baldwin and the new council. Be careful with doling out incentives of any kind. Folks at the North Carolina Department of Commerce and Wake County Economic Development will have you believe CEOs and boards of companies looking to relocate or expand operations consider incentives to be a primary factor in relocation, but it is not. The theory has been debunked simply by looking at history. Sure, some projects have flourished because of the cash and credit boost from the government, but that money never plays a role in a company's success or failure, ever. A better plan would be to incentivize existing businesses by streamlining rules, cutting fees, and offering expansion help. Raleigh is about to change, and we can't wait to chronicle this new journey. And this week's business survey pulse, which is better, Bojangles or Chick-fil-A? Of the 159 responses, 77% said Chick-fil-A and the 23% said Bojangles. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. So if you have any comments, call us at 919-832-5133.